Abu Hamid al-Ghazali, who died in 1111, is one of the most famous Muslim thinkers in history. His autobiographical account, The Deliverer from Error, tells us of his spiritual crisis and transformative experience of journeying, which led to his subsequent life as a pious recluse. From this experience, al-Ghazali wrote his magnum opus, The Revival of the Religious Sciences, filled with mystical knowledge. At least that is how it's generally been read in the Euro-American tradition. Kenneth Garden, associate professor at Tufts University, re-examines al-Ghazali's work from a historical hermeneutical perspective in The First Islamic Reviver, Abu Hamid al-Ghazali and His Revival of Religious Sciences, published with Oxford University Press in 2014. Garden outlines the social and political context of al-Ghazali's life, demonstrating he was an active participant in the Seljuk Empire. A close reading of The Revival of Religious Sciences reveals al-Ghazali's promotion of a revivalist vision of the tradition, which he called the science of the hereafter. Garden also presents the strategies al-Ghazali utilized to campaign for the revival, the tactics of his opponents, and the historical context that may force us to rethink the purpose of his autobiography, The Deliverer from Error. In our conversation, we discussed al-Ghazali's social and political life, his relationship to philosophy and mysticism, the connections between his early and later writings, the content of The Revival of Religious Sciences, accusations against him and his legal trial, and what led to the widespread popularity and influence of al-Ghazali's work. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Kenneth Garden. Welcome, Ken. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on.
Now, it's our tradition here at New Books in Islamic Studies to find out a little bit about our authors. So before we get into the book, can you tell us a little bit about your background, training, how you got interested in Islamic studies?
Yeah, so my route to Islamic studies was kind of roundabout, actually. When I was an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin, I went on a junior year abroad in Germany. So I was spending a year in Bonn, which at the time was the capital of West Germany still. And I lived in a dormitory that was further away from the university, kind of on the outskirts of the town. And a lot of my fellow dorm mates were Syrians, Palestinians, Jordanians who had come to Germany to study because you could do that for free. There was no tuition charged. And I lived in a, instead of having a cafeteria, every five rooms shared a kitchen and a bathroom. So some of my kitchen mates were Palestinian. And this was during the time of the First Intifada. And I had never really given any thought to the region at all, to the Middle East. And but talking to them and meeting some of their friends, I got interested in modern politics. And when I went back to the University of Wisconsin at the end of a year, I had an intention to continue studying modern history, modern politics, only to find that nobody on the faculty there at the time taught that. But Stephen Humphreys, who's now at University of California, Santa Barbara, he was there at the time teaching classes on medieval Islam. So I got interested, through these classes in medieval history. I started studying Arabic at the time with Dustin Cowell at the University of Wisconsin. And later, I finished graduate school. I went back to Europe for a while. I taught English in the former Czechoslovakia and in the former East Germany in Dresden. And for a time, I considered, continuing with comparative literature, which is something I'd done as an undergraduate and maybe German literature, but then decided to go back to continue with my studies of Arabic. So I did that in, taking more classes, back living in Madison, Wisconsin. Again, I took some classes with Michael Chamberlain, who had replaced Stephen Humphreys, and I started studying Arabic, continuing Arabic at the University of Chicago in the summer during their summer program, and eventually was admitted to graduate school there, again, with the intention of focusing on history. And I was caught up with the romance of Al-Andalus at the time, of Muslim Spain, as they say. So I went to Madrid for a couple of months in the fall of 1998, and met Maribel Fierro at the at a research institute there in Madrid, and she suggested that I work on the burning of Razali's Revival of the Religious Sciences, which, according to some sources, happened in Cordoba in 1109. So I came back to the States and started working on the burning. Again, this is going to be more of a history project. But I started to drift away from the burning itself, since there weren't great sources, there weren't very many detailed descriptions of it, and started to get, more interested in studying the revival. And also then a short work that Razavi had written defending the revival. And some people had suggested that since his only known critics were these Andalusis, that this might be a response he had written to the burning of the revival in Cordoba. So, reading that, I discovered that it couldn't have been a response to the burning in Cordoba. Then I, kind of connected that refutation of his critics to a controversy described in his letters that Joseph Annes had written about. And that took me into studying the revival, studying, controversies over it. And that led me more into an Islamic studies direction, into studies of the Islamic, religious tradition, and less of social history. Although I guess the social historical aspect has always been a part also of my, my religious studies interest.
Yeah, it's really interesting how this project took you along. Now, in the book that you wrote, you begin with the autobiography of al-Ghazali, and some of our listeners, while they may have heard of him, may only know of him through this autobiography or even just kind of short introductions. Can you tell us a little bit about how he presents himself in this autobiography and how Western academics have understood and interpreted this biography?
Yeah, so the biography, it's a short work of his called The Deliverer from Error, literally The Deliverer from Error, although it's usually been translated as The Deliverance from Error. The book has been popular in Western, among Western audiences, and especially I think in the English-speaking world. There are translations into most other European, so major European languages, but there are no fewer than five translations into English, which is really quite surprising. And in this book, Razavi talks about his own, it's some people present it as an autobiography, although most of the things that we would think of or expect to find in an autobiography aren't in it. We don't hear anything about his childhood or his family or his parents or anything like that. It's really more of trying to give a context for the development of his own, thought. Some have called it an intellectual autobiography. And he does so in pretty compelling terms. He talks about two crises that occurred in his life. A youthful crisis of skepticism, where he started to wonder how it was that he could know what he knew, and slowly beginning to, to doubt one certainty after the next, where he, began to doubt sense perception, since astronomical proofs showed that although a star might seem to be only the size of a coin, in fact, it was larger than the entire Earth and so on. And then even logic, that or mathematical proofs, so that 10 is larger than 3. He began to doubt even this and fell into a crisis of radical skepticism, which he said he suffered through for about 2 months, in which he, couldn't really accede to the truth of anything. But he says that eventually he was cured of this, not by any of his own efforts, but because of a light that God cast into his heart. And after that, his life work was to try to find a criterion for the truth. And he said that there were four schools of thought in his age that offered this this criterion, and they were the theologians, the Mutakallimun, the philosophers, the Ismaili Shiites, and then the Sufis, or mystics, I guess they're often called. So he looked at these schools one by one, and he says that he rejected them one by one. He eliminated them as possible paths to the truth. The theology, he said, was fine for refuting heretics, but really didn't offer a sure path to the truth. He assessed and then rejected philosophy. He assessed and rejected the claim of the Ismaili Shiites to have a divinely guided and therefore infallible leader or imam. And finally, he came to assessing the claims of the Sufis and agreed that theirs was a path to the truth. But having made this realization was one thing, and actually acting on it, becoming a Sufi, putting Sufi practices to work in his own life was something else. And he said that at times he would wake up in the morning, with a resolve to leave his worldly success. He was, at that time, he was the head professor at the Nizamiya College or Madrasa in Baghdad at the time, one of the most prestigious centers of learning in the Muslim world at the time. He says that he had some 300 students. And that he found it very difficult to leave this prestigious position of his, and as he would sometimes try to convince himself, he felt he had an obligation to his students also. But finally, he said that he sort of wavered back and forth on this. But finally, he said God sealed the matter for him by first of all robbing him of his ability to speak, and so he could no longer teach his students, and then robbing him of his power of digestion, so he couldn't eat anymore. The doctors despaired of a cure. They thought that there was no saving him, but he knew what the root of this crisis was, and therefore he knew how to go about solving it. And he gave up his position. He told the caliph that he was going away on pilgrimage to Mecca, but in fact what he did was to go away to Damascus first, where he practiced the Sufi path and found and confirmed what he had come to believe about it, that it was a path to sure knowledge. And that he was healed then by this this pursuit of the Sufi path. And after 2 years, he writes, he's spending about 2 years in the Levant. And after about 2 years, his children needed him back, and so he answered the call of his family as he felt was his duty, and he returned to his home region of Khorasan, northeastern Iran, to the town of Tus. And spent about 10 years there, again, pursuing he said that, of course, there were many issues that came up that he had to address, but that in stolen moments, and he was able to continue to practice Sufism, and, he's reaped the benefits of that. And then he felt a need to return to teaching again. He had left his position in 488, and in 499, then he was summoned to return to teaching by the Sultan Sanjar in Nishapur. And he had been at the Nizamiya Madrasa in Baghdad. Now he was returning to the Nizamiya Madrasa in Nishapur, a college, a madrasa founded by his former patron, Nizam al-Mulk. But he felt that this experience that he had had along the way, he argues that the experience he'd had along the way of assessing the claims of different schools of thought and learning how to refute false claims and learning how to recognize true claims had given him a skill that his, a divinely granted skill ultimately that his age needed, and that he knew that that God had guided him to. And he also felt, on his own judgment, and also on the judgment of some of his contemporaries, that he might be the renewer of the fifth Islamic century. So there was a hadith, a saying of the Prophet that said that God will send to his community at the head of every century whosoever will renew for it the affairs of its religion. And from this then comes the tradition of the Mujaddid, or the renewer, that every century will see a renewer. And there are different interpretations of this. So he felt that he was a divine renewer of his century. And again, that his return to teaching was a, although he, before had left his position and thought that he was the last person in the world ever to return to officially sanctioned teaching again, he felt that that God had guided him, to his position in life, and that it was a divine mandate for him to take up this task that he had been appointed to, and to, share the fruits of his introspection and share the fruits of his studies with a world that was badly in need of guidance at the time. So this is a picture of Ghazali that emerges from the Reviver.
And of course, part of what you're doing in the book is reassessing this in light of it being written at the end of his career. And earlier in the book, you give us a kind of a pre-crisis snapshot, an intellectual account based on one of his earlier texts.
And yes.
Yeah. Could you talk about this, the scale of action as this text? And here it gives us a snapshot of some of his thoughts on things like mysticism and philosophical mm-hmm. thought, and gives us a portrait of him at this pre-crisis period. Can you frame this for us?
Yeah. So in the the reviver, the deliverer from error. So we see Razali talking about his own deliberations on the eve of leaving teaching, right? And that says that he had embraced Sufism, and that he really he was racked with doubts, about whether he could leave or not leave. He had recognized the truth of Sufism, but he hadn't actually put it into practice. And until you put it into practice, of course, it's only then that you can really sort of reap the fruits of Sufi practice. So he sees him, he presents himself as somebody, sort of racked with doubt about whether he can take up the Sufi practice or not, and somebody who hasn't really, come to any solid insights based on Sufism yet, since he hasn't practiced it. And so looking at the revival of the religious sciences, I had, some doubts originally, and I guess I'll talk about these later, about whether it really was simply Sufism that he had come to practice later on. And one of the things that I did was to look at since the revival is a work of ethics that he started writing and reading from, even really within months of leaving Baghdad. This was an expression of his post-Baghdad vision. That if I looked at another work of ethics that he finished writing almost immediately before leaving Baghdad, that it would be interesting to compare and see what sort of continuities or discontinuities there was in his in his Baghdad thought and his post-Baghdad thought. And the if his thinking at the time is accurately described in The Deliverer from Error, then you'd expect many of these uncertainties of his to be reflected in the Mizan al-Amal, in his scale of action. And I found that really wasn't the case, and that if you look at the scale of action, he's talking about a very different set of concerns. He starts the book by talking about the necessity of pursuing as-sa'ada or as-sa'ada al-ukhrawiyya, which is often translated in English as felicity. And felicity in the hereafter. Now what is felicity? This is a concept that really comes from the philosophical tradition. And one of the thinkers who had elaborated on this idea of felicity, and whose fingerprints are all over Razali's thought, is the Persian philosopher Ibn Sina, whose works were translated into Latin, were very influential also in the Western Christian tradition, where he was known as Avicenna. And Ibn Sina had taken this idea, the idea of felicity in the hereafter was common in the philosophical tradition. And this is different from simple salvation. Ibn Sina believed that common believers, who follow the law and practice their rituals and did not commit any grave sins, would have najat or salvation in the hereafter. But he also held, like philosophers, that there was a higher kind of afterlife that could be achieved. This is felicity. And in some ways, this is I think you could be understood as a kind of a direct translation from, the Aristotelian idea of eudaimonia, only really understood in the hereafter. Felicity is not a matter simply of enjoying the kinds of pleasures that are described in the Quran, often in bodily terms, but was it understood rather as a completely non-physical, completely intellectual pleasure in the hereafter. And the substance of this is to behold God, to contemplate God, for all of eternity in the hereafter. And God, being the most perfect entity in existence, is also the being most worthy of love. So to contemplate God is also to feel a love of God. The love that one feels for God equals the knowledge one has of God. And as one contemplates God, a limitless, infinite being over all of eternity, the knowledge of God constantly grows. And with it then constantly grows the love that you feel for God. And therefore, thereby the felicity that you experience in the hereafter. And this felicity, this knowledge of God is achieved according to the philosophical path through a twofold method. On the one hand, there is what was called the practical science, and within the practical science had three subdivisions: politics, economics being the how to run a household, and ethics. And then in addition to that, there was the theoretical science, and this was using the syllogism, using logic, using rationality to understand the workings of the universe, the architecture of the universe, and through understanding the architecture of the universe, then to understand the architect or God. The practical science, especially ethics, was necessary because we live in a physical world here, and to inhabit a physical world, we have to have a physical body. But this causes certain problems because the body has its own requirements. For the body to protect itself against predators or enemies, the body has to have the faculty of anger. And because the body, bodies need to reproduce themselves, there's also an appetite for sex. Bodies have to nourish themselves, and therefore there's an appetite for food. And from these then can spring, rage, lust, gluttony, things that root us in the body and the requirements of the body, and turn us away from the telos, from the purpose for which we've been created, which is to pursue knowledge of God and therefore and thereby felicity. So what you have to do then is pursue ethics. The branch of the practical science, the most important for the pursuit of felicity, is ethics. And that is to try to order the self in such a way that the rational faculty, our faculty of reason, subordinates the passions, the appetites and anger. And once they're subordinated and put into their proper role, then our rational faculty is left free to pursue knowledge of God. So once once ethics has done its work and the correct ordering of our psychology has been achieved, the rational faculty dominating the appetites and anger, then we can then begin to pursue the theoretical science and start pursuing knowledge of God. And this is really this is ultimately Neoplatonism. Some of the ideas are simply Platonic. When we look around the world, we see certain things, physical entities in the world like trees, but we can abstract from these entities their form or Platonic form of treeness. Again, looking at the world, we can begin to understand the world of the forms. And then, beyond the world of forms, the different sort of celestial entities, the spheres and so on, and eventually rise from the physical world in which we are, we find ourselves in this life, towards the immaterial, intellectual world of the different spheres and of God. So ultimately, of course, we want to seek God for the sake of felicity, for his own sake, but also, for felicity. So this then is the philosophical school. And when Razali writes about felicity, the necessity of pursuing felicity in the hereafter, this is really a philosophical idea that he's elaborating on here. But in the Mise en, he also says that there are two different schools of pursuing felicity. And one is the school of, the term he uses here is theoreticians, navar. Now, I don't have time to get into it here, but I argue in the book that by navar, he really means philosophy or philosophers. The navar, the theoreticians, are philosophers. Not just any philosophers, but, those philosophers whose practices he agrees with. And the other school then is Sufism. Now, as we've seen in the philosophical approach, you have this two-track pursuit of felicity through ethics or the practical science and also the theoretical science. And he says that what distinguishes the Sufis from the philosophers is that they pursue ethics, the practical science alone, and that by undertaking Sufi practices, they can overcome their appetites to such an extent that at some point knowledge will be spontaneously revealed to them. So rather than gradually accumulating knowledge the way that philosophers do, the Sufi method is to pursue practice alone, ethics alone, but in a much more extreme way, and eventually hoping to have this kind of mystical insight, this sort of moment of immediate revelation of all the same kind of knowledge that philosophers can achieve. Now, these two schools are not equal in Razali's eyes. In his discussion of these two schools, he says that he has a chapter called the primary of the two paths, or the superior of the two paths. And there he says that on the one hand, he says that there is no superior of the two paths, that it really depends on the individual and which path they're more suited to. So he says that if you want to pursue the path of the theoreticians, and read here philosophers, again, this is my argument, that you have to come to the practice when you're young enough. If you're too old, you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, as they say. So if you're too old, you won't be able to, you know, to learn this method, this philosophical method. Secondly, you have to be smart enough to do it. So, you know, not everyone has the intelligence, the intellect to pursue the philosophical method. This is a second criteria. And the third criterion is that you have to have a qualified instructor. So if you don't meet all of these three criterion, if you're not smart enough, or you're not young enough, or you don't have a qualified instructor, then you should pursue the Sufi path. But he goes on to say that he gives a critique, though, of the Sufi path from the perspective of the theoreticians. And the critique is that a Sufi, you know, if they come to a certain insight, the insight they come to might actually be a delusional insight. It might not be a true insight into the nature of things. And whereas a philosopher has syllogistics, has logic, a way of interrogating this insight and determining whether it's true or not, he says that within a minute, you know, that they can see through a delusional insight, that a Sufi doesn't have this tool at their disposal. And he says in the scale of action that they can be held captive to this insight for 10 years. Now, in the same passage as it appears in the revival, he says 20 years. This could be a copyist's error or something, but it's interesting to see that minor change. He also gives another critique, which is that the ascetic practices practiced by Sufis, you know, fasting and so on, long periods of isolation, long periods of prayer and so on, can also lead to, you know, to confusion and bodily illness, and that this is also not very productive in trying to, you know, to pursue felicity. So ultimately, you know, he sees two possible paths to pursue, but it seems quite clear that his own preference is for the philosophical path. And then he points to a third possibility, and that is that somebody who has pursued the philosophical path to its end and really come to all of the insight that one can come to through the philosophical path, he says, and he shows some hesitation here. This is a tentative suggestion, it seems to me. He says, there is no harm at that point in pursuing the Sufi path as well. It might possibly lead to further insights still. And he gives an interesting parable that we find also in the Revival of the Religious Sciences. He says he talks about a contest held by a king who decided to see which of two groups of artisans was more skillful. He invited a group of Byzantine artisans and a group of Chinese artisans and wanted each of them to decorate a wall within a large hall. So the Byzantines were given one wall to decorate, and across the hall, you know, immediately opposite, was the wall that the Chinese were given to decorate, the Chinese artisans. And so a curtain was drawn between the two groups so that they couldn't see one another. The Byzantines asked for all sorts of exotic pigments and brushes and so on, and began to, you know, to paint the wall that they had been given to decorate. And the Chinese asked only for polishing materials for polishing. And this, everyone was quite surprised at this, but they obliged. They went ahead and gave them the polishing materials. And then at some point down the road, the Byzantines announced that they had completed their wall, that their design was done. And the Chinese announced then immediately upon hearing this that theirs was done as well. And everyone was also surprised about this coincidence. But then they drew back the curtain between the two walls, and everyone was able to see the beautiful pattern that the Byzantines had painted in their wall. And on the other side of the wall, you could see the Chinese. What they had done, the Chinese artisans, was to polish the wall to a mural-like finish. And it reflected, therefore, since it was immediately, you know, opposite the Byzantine wall, it mirrored the Byzantine pattern. But because the wall had been polished to such a brilliant finish, the reflection in the Byzantine, or in the Chinese, the wall that had been polished by the Chinese was more dazzling and brilliant yet than the wall that had been painted by the Byzantines. And so, on the one hand, this suggests that, you know, obviously the Byzantines, this is the philosophical path. The Chinese, this is the Sufi path. And it suggests that they come to the same insight, but that the direct witnessing of the Sufis may be more dazzling, more impressive still than that of the philosophical path.
That's a great story too. Now, the revival of the religious sciences, Al-Ghazali elaborates in great detail on many of these topics. He also reclassifies many of these ideas, presenting them in new terminological perspectives. And he really, you argue, highlights this idea of revival in this text.
Right.
So could you give us kind of a brief snapshot of what this text looks like? It's a magnum opus, and then how this idea of revival is presented.
Right. Yeah. So one more comparison with the scale of action is useful here. One of the passages there that really struck me, just in revealing Ghazali's mindset and where what he saw his mission as in the scale of action. Still, he says he complains that although the telos of human life, the very purpose for which we were created, is to seek felicity, that most human beings are not only don't pursue it, but aren't even aware of this most necessary of all tasks. And he says that this is because their appetites are constantly upon them, and they're sort of turned away from this purpose. And he says that the only person who could awaken them to this vital necessity would be a preacher of faultless conduct, and the world is empty of them, he says. And my sense in reading this, and especially in looking later at the revival of the religious sciences, is that Ghazali saw himself as this preacher of flawless conduct. The Ghazali that emerges from the scale of action is not a man who's tormented with doubt or standing ambivalently between different paths and wondering what to do. He's summoning other people to pursue felicity, and I think you can only conclude that he was quite confident about his own achievements in this to begin with. And insofar as he favors the philosophical school in the scale of action, it seems quite clear that his achievement, such as it had been at that point, was through philosophy. And he tells another interesting story there. He says that his knowledge about the Sufi path comes from a Sufi authority that he had consulted. And he said he had consulted him about a Sufi practice of continuously reciting the Quran, and that the Sufi authority had forbidden him. He said that the Sufi path requires complete commitment. And insofar as you're still, caught up in concerns of family and career and so on, you're unable to do it. So we see a clear statement in the scale of action that he hadn't yet studied, he hadn't yet practiced philosophy, and that his knowledge of the philosophical, practice was secondhand, and that he seems to have practiced philosophy. On the other hand, he hadn't practiced Sufism but had practiced philosophy. So when it comes to the revival of the religious sciences, what I see the revival is doing is really taking this concern of Ghazali's, not for just spelling out a doctrine, but rather for making it the imperative of pursuing felicity, making this seem evident to his readership. He's trying to win over a readership and trying to convince them of the necessity of this task. And this is why you see, the scale of action. I mean, what does this say? It's a scale, it's a balance. And this is, again, comes from Aristotelian ethics, but, a balance for determining what correct action is. It's not a title that seems overly ambitious. But if you just stop to let the title of the revival of the religious sciences sink in, it's quite an ambitious work. It suggests that the religious sciences of Ghazali's day were dead, and that he is going to set about bringing them back to life. The topic, much of this plain discussion about felicity, which is there from the very beginning in the scale of action, it's toned down to a great extent. It's still there, and you can find it in many passages throughout the revival, but it's toned down. And whereas in the scale he talks, of course the scale is a work of ethics, but he also talks about the theoretical science and refers his readers to another work of his, the you know, for discussion of theory. And the revival of the religious sciences, you know, he really focuses on practice alone, but he's changed the terminology. And so its debt to philosophy isn't as immediately as apparent as it is in the scale of action. The overall science that Rosati advocates in the revival of the religious sciences is what he calls the science of the hereafter, or ilm al-akhirah in Arabic. And he says that the science of the hereafter has two subdisciplines within it, and these are the science of praxis, and then the science of unveiling. So, and these, it seems to me, are really just, you know, taking the two philosophical disciplines that I referred to before, the practical science, al-ilm al-amali, on the one hand, and the theoretical science, al-ilm al-nadhari, on the other hand, and sort of repackaging them, retitling them, and then presenting them again in the revival with certain differences. I'm not insisting that they're that there were no changes in his thought. I think we do see certain changes and certain things fleshed out in the revival in a way that we don't see in the scale of action. He says then that the science of unveiling, ilm al-mukashifa, is not something that you should talk about in public. It's really something that's for initiates only, for people who have experienced it. And so he says the science of unveiling, or the theoretical science, if we want to use the philosophical term, is something he won't be discussing in the revival, although there are many passages in which he does discuss elements of it or topics that relate to that science of unveiling. And so what he will be focusing on is the science of praxis, of mu'amala. And so this then is what he'll be discussing, really ethics alone. And one of the things that he has to do, you know, so in what way then is this a revival of the religious sciences? You know, in what way are the religious sciences to be considered dead? And what does it mean to revive them? Well, Ghazali writes that this science of the hereafter used to be the primary concern of the Prophet, of course, the companions of the Prophet, the Sahaba, and also the founders of the four legal schools, the A'ima. So Imam Shafi'i, Malik ibn Anas, Abu Hanifa, and Ahmad ibn Hanbal. And he says that that pursuing the science of the hereafter, that is to say, pursuing felicity, was their primary concern. They were also saw certain secondary concerns. In order for people to know how to practice their rituals correctly, and also because of the necessity for a law in any society, law, fiqh, you know, jurisprudence, was also seen as a kind of unfortunate necessity. A religious science, to be sure, but not the primary focus. And secondly, then, because heresy was always something that threatened the community, theology or kalam was also an unfortunate necessity. Nobody's primary concern, but something that people did secondarily as a service to the community. But he said what happened is that these two sciences then went from being subordinate sciences to the primary science, the science of the hereafter, and ended up eclipsing the science of the hereafter and becoming the primary focus of religious scholars. And this is because by practicing the law, one can become a judge and become a prominent figure and have, you know, authority and even wealth by practicing the law. And also in the case of theology, it's, you know, hard to believe this from a 21st century perspective, but apparently watching, you know, public theological debate was seen as a great entertainment. And so he talks about different practices of public theological debate in which the winner might be, you know, rewarded, you know, given a monetary reward for winning a debate. And he says in this way, then these sciences, law and theology, which he categorizes as in contrast to the otherworldly science or the science of the hereafter, he refers to these as the sciences of the world, the ulum ad-dunya. And he says that the ulum ad-dunya, the worldly sciences, have eclipsed the science of the hereafter. And this is exactly the opposite of the way that things should be. So his revival of the religious sciences amounts to restoring the original state of affairs, making the science of the hereafter the primary focus of the religious sciences once again. That's not to say that the law is unimportant. The first half of the book, the first 20 chapters or kutub, books of the revival of the religious sciences, are mostly devoted to legal issues. And this was a great concern of Ghazali's in the latter part of his life. There were people, philosophers, Sufis, and others who thought of themselves as so intellectually superior that practicing the 5 daily prayers and other rituals, fasting during Ramadan, that these were no longer incumbent upon them, that they could could disregard these requirements. And he refers to them as the ahl al-ibaha, so as the ibahiyya, so I guess you could translate this as antinomians. And this is something that he criticizes. He wrote a tract about this later in life in Persian. One of the books of the Persian version of the Revival of the Religious Sciences, The Alchemy of Felicity, is also devoted to a critique of these antinomians. So he insists that practicing the law is crucial, and he gives that the first 10 books of the Revival, or most of the first 10 books of the Revival, are about how to, you know, practice the rituals in accordance with the law. But he also insists that these rituals point beyond themselves, that on the one hand, they contain divine wisdom, and that practicing prayer, for example, or washing before prayer, tahara, so washing for maintaining ritual prayer for ritual activities, that there is a divine wisdom in this that helps us along the path to the hereafter in ways that we can't really understand or explain rationally, but nonetheless is there. He also says, though, that as you perform, for example, ritual purity, it's not enough simply to wash your limbs, in water to remove external impurities, while your heart, as he says, is full of corruption, of sin and vice. So you also have to cleanse your interior of sin and vice, that this is implicit in the ritual of washing before prayer or maintaining a state of ritual purity during pilgrimage, for example. And beyond that, he says that the highest implementation of ritual purity is to cleanse the heart of anything but God, to devote yourself to God alone, so that your heart, which, you know, he also is another way that he has of speaking of the soul, so that your heart has only one concern, which is God, and reflecting ultimately the divine reality. And so he takes the law. He insists on its importance. He incorporates it into his larger, ethical project and his revivalist project, his project for trying to achieve felicity in the hereafter. He insists on its necessity, but he also weaves it into his larger project, and weaves it in also with philosophical and also Sufi ethics. The Revival is often taken to be a work of Sufism, but in the first book, there's an interesting passage which Alexander Traeger actually called my attention to, where Ghazali points out that this science of the hereafter is a necessity. It is a fard, it's an obligatory science for everyone to pursue, at least for all religious scholars to pursue. Sufism, though, is not an obligatory science. So in other words, this science of the hereafter that he's advocating in the Revival is not identical with Sufism. And clearly, Sufism continues to play a role, I think a role that's very similar to the role he spelled out for it in the Criterion for Action. But it's what he's advocating in the Revival, the science of the hereafter, is not identical with Sufism. Later in the books, he writes about, there are large passages that were drawn from various Sufi thinkers, including Mahasabi and Abul Talib al-Makki and others. And there are, interestingly, the passage that I talked about, this comparison between the theoreticians or philosophers on the one hand and the Sufis on the other, is reproduced almost exactly in the Revival. And in the Revival is divided into four quarters, into 40 books, into four quarters, and also into two halves. And Ghazali himself writes that the first two books, books 21 and 22 of the Revival, are the introduction to the second half. And in the first of these, book 21, the book of the wonders of the heart or the marvels of the heart. This passage comparing the philosophers to the Sufis that we find in the scale of action is reproduced almost word for word, also in the Revival. So this schemework, this framework, this schema of Ghazali's did not really change from the scale of action to the revival. It's present in the revival, and it also leads me to wonder whether Book 21 might not have been one of the first ones that Ghazali wrote after leaving Baghdad. It might have been one of the first that he read from, there is evidence that he did already in Damascus shortly after his arrival there.
Now, the social life of this text is largely tied to al-Ghazali's network of scholars and statesmen. And instead of being an inward-directed spiritual seeker, he was really tied into promoting this text and promoting himself as this reviver. Can you tell us a little bit about this afterlife of the text, I guess?
Yeah, well, this is a view of Ghazali's life that's at odds with a view that I take to be pervasive in our understanding of Ghazali and in much of, you know, the Ghazali scholarship. And that is, you know, in one article that I've written, I compare him to the wise man on the mountaintop. And that's an image that we have. It's a Western image, right, of the the seeker goes, you know, trekking in the Himalayas. You know, he comes up to a mountaintop and he sees a man, you know, sort of sitting, cross-legged, being wise and there to dispense wisdom. So divorced of any sort of worldly concerns. It's an image. If you saw the recent Star Wars movie, you know, at the end of the recent Star Wars movie, we find Luke Skywalker off on some remote planet, on a mountaintop, you know, sitting there, you know, and he is standing there when the character comes up and wants to give him his lightsaber back. Now, what has he been eating all this time? Where has he been living? Where do his clothes come from? Who does he talk to? None of these kinds of questions, you know, are answered. And it seems to me that this image of Ghazali is the solitary wanderer, the solitary spiritual seeker, is very much in lines with this this trope of the wise man on the mountaintop. But if you look at Ghazali's life as it emerges from biographies of him, including with biographies written by his contemporary, Abdul Ghafir al-Farisi, and also by looking at his letters that have been preserved in mostly in Persian, a very different image of Ghazali emerges. And far from being somebody, you know, a sort of solitary, you know, inward-directed spiritual seeker concerned mainly with his own salvation, I see him rather as somebody who had a very, outward-directed agenda. A project, a revivalist project. He didn't just write the book and let it speak for itself. He actively tried, you know, to promote it in ways that come across in his letters. Now, Ghazali, from the very beginning of his career, worked very closely with political figures in the Seljuk Empire. He was a protege of Nizam al-Mulk, and spent, I think, the first 6 years of his career living in Nizam al-Mulk's court in Esfahan. And when he came to Baghdad in the first place to take up his position at the Nizamiya Madrasa, which his patron, Nizam al-Mulk, had founded, Nizam al-Mulk fired two other instructors to make room for him there. So the fact that he took up this position was no accident. It was a very conscious choice made by Nizam al-Mulk. Ghazali, when he was there, spoke, you know, he had audiences with the Sultan, with Malik Shah, with Nizam al-Mulk, of course, with the Caliph. He was very well connected then in these circles. He knew many of the sons of Nizam al-Mulk after Nizam al-Mulk's assassination. He maintained his correspondence with some of the sons of Nizam al-Mulk, and some of these letters survive. And he used his networks for various aims. He used, you know, during this time of his wandering, right, we often think of him, you know, sort of wandering alone through the desert, but we know that he had at least one companion. There's a man who he writes about, Ibrahim al-Sabak, who he writes of as being his companion throughout all of his travels. And this man is living in Jorjan, I believe, and Ghazali writes to one of the sons of Nizam al-Mulk and asks that that he help him out in his career and maybe help him out against some of his enemies. So we can assume that if this Ibrahim al-Sabak was Ghazali's companion in the post-Baghdad period, that he was probably also a fellow traveler in terms of his revivalist project as well. And that, you know, helping out Ibrahim al-Sabak was about helping a friend, but maybe also helping out a comrade as in the science of the hereafter. He writes to young people to try to win them over. There's a letter in which he writes to a young person to try to win him over to the study of the science of the hereafter. We see at least one letter where he writes to the father of a student. And you can imagine that, many fathers who send their children, off to study religious sciences are hoping that they'll, have an illustrious career as a judge. And that this idea of them, sort of renouncing law as a science of a worldly science and embracing instead some ascetic science of the hereafter isn't what every father dreams of for his son. So we see a letter in which he writes to a father of one of his students to try to, encourage him to allow him to continue his studies with Razavi of the science of the hereafter. And we also see him, and this is quite interesting, writing a letter to Fakhr al-Mulk, the son of Nizam al-Mulk, who, it's quite clear from the letter, is his disciple. He gives him instruction in the science of the hereafter and then recommends that for further instruction, he look at Razali's Persian version of the revival, his Alchemy of Felicity, the Kimiyaya Saadat. And it's no coincidence then that when Razali finally did return to teaching in Nishapur in 499, it was at the behest of Fakhr al-Mulk. Fakhr al-Mulk didn't just, turn to him as an old, sort of family, employee, if you want to look at it that way, or as a qualified scholar to take up a position to fill a vacancy at the Nizamiya. As his disciple, Fakhr al-Mulk knew perfectly well what Razali's revivalist project was. He was on board with it. And we can only think that when he appointed Razali to return to teaching there, it was for the sake then of being able to promote now from a more official position from this Nizamiya Madrasa, his revivalist agenda.
Now, with all this historical context coming to light, we should then rethink this text, The Deliverer from Error. So if we re-examine The Deliverer in this new light, what can we conclude about its purpose, its function, and how it's written?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I've read the revival and reread. The Deliverer. I've read and reread this book, over the years, and I always find new things in it. It's an ingenious work that works on many different levels and many different fronts. It's quite a sophisticated and complicated work. I'm just reading an article right now by Taneli Kokkonen, who looks to it for to see certain sort of systematic positions that Razali is working out in it. There are a lot of things going on in it. But the element of the work that I focus on is its two elements really. The first is its role as an apology. So we know from the letters that once and also from other sources that when Razali returned to teaching in 1106 in 499 1106 that. A controversy broke out in Nishapur. So we know he was appointed by Fakhr al-Mulk, who is his disciple, but we also know that Fakhr al-Mulk was assassinated shortly after Razali took up his position at the Nizamiya in Nishapur. And then a controversy over his thought broke out. And it seems to have been quite a vicious one. He was denounced. People wrote fatwas against him. He was harassed. We know from one of the letters that he writes during the controversy that he was writing not from Nishapur, but from Tus. We have to wonder if he might have fled the city. And we also know from looking at, there was a text that I mentioned earlier, Al-Imla fi Ishkalat al-Lihya, the composition on the problems of the revival or the critiques of the revival from a text that Razali wrote in response to his critics, that one of the things that they focused on was his an allegory that he gives, a cosmological allegory that he gives in Book 35 of the Revival, the Book of Divine Unity and Reliance on God. It's referred to in short as the Allegory of the Pens. We know also that from this and other sources that Razali was accused of a few different things. He was accused of philosophical influence. And frankly, based on, many different studies that have been done in recent years and going back, longer than that, that Razali himself, was heavily influenced by philosophy and by Avicenna in particular. He was a critic. His was a critical engagement with Avicenna's thought, but still, he was heavily influenced by Avicenna. So this criticism is true. And the other one was that he was accused of being an Ismaili. And so when we see him then using, you know, I mentioned there was this schema that he uses of the four classes of the seekers, theologians, philosophers, Ismaili Shiites, and Sufis. It's no accident that he adopts this. And when I say adopt it, I mean adopt it. As Joseph Van Ness pointed out, he's not the first one to employ this schema. It seems to have been kind of it was used before him and a few years before him by Omar Khayyam, who was from Nishapur and who Razali met and talked apparently astronomy with. And so it wasn't like this was something that simply emerged, you know, organically in Razali's life, and he's just passing it on when he wrote The Deliverer. It seems to me that he uses it, among other things, as a tool to try to distance himself, you know, from these charges that he was a drawing on philosophy and Ismaili Shiism. And so, you know, this, you know, also this. Story of the, you know, the crisis that led him to leave his position in Baghdad. You know, while of course I have to assume that this radical change in his life had to have been a wrenching one for him. You know, again, my study of the scale of action on the one hand, his pre-crisis, if you want to think of it that way, scale of action on the one hand, and the post-crisis revival of the religious sciences suggests that actually. The transition in his life and in his thinking wasn't the way he described it in The Deliverer from Error, and that he did this again to try to distance himself from these schools of thought that he was accused of adhering to. Also, one interesting thing that we learned from his letters is that one of the things that he did after he left Baghdad was to take a series of vows. He went to the tomb of Abraham in Hebron, and there he took a vow never again to appear before a ruler, never again to take money from a ruler, never again to engage in public theological debate, and in one of the tellings, never again to engage in ta'asub, or partisan fanaticism, meaning in the case of Nishapur, Khorasan generally at this time, being a fanatical partisan either of the Hanafi legal school or the Shafi'i legal school. So this is another important element. You know, it sheds important light, I think, on Razali's concerns and mindset, you know, at this time, that really doesn't find any reflection in The Deliverer from Error. It was a text that was really written with a different set of concerns in mind, and especially the one that I focus on here is the concern of distancing, you know, of himself from these schools of thought he had been accused of adhering to. And The Deliverer wasn't the only text that he wrote in response to this. He wrote, you know, as I mentioned before, the composition on the problems of the revival. So the distinguishing criterion between Islam and masked infidelity, it's been translated this way, Faisala Tafrika Bain al-Islam wa Zandaqa. And also, during the course of this controversy, he was called for a hearing before the Seljuk king of the East, Sanjar. And after the hearing, after Razali was acquitted by Sanjar, Sanjar went hunting and had some wild game sent to Razali. Razali responded then by writing Nasihat-e Maluk, the sort of advice for kings, for Sanjar. So really, four of Razali's later texts emerge from this controversy, and understanding the controversy and what was at stake in it is really crucial for understanding Razali's later writings, and especially given the central role that the Munkar has played in shaping our understanding of Razali and really giving us this sort of wise man on the mountaintop image of him. You know, I think you know, it's really vital that we understand the circumstances in which it was read and what some of its rhetorical aims were, so that we can try to sort out those elements that can guide us to a deeper understanding of Razali's thought and some of those elements in his rhetoric that I think lead us astray from a more accurate understanding of what he stood for.
Hmm. Well, Ken, you've written a wonderful book, and I'm sure listeners are eager to hear about what you're working on now.
Right. Well, right now, I'm returning to something that I worked on in my dissertation. You know, again, this question of the controversy over Razali's revival in Al-Andalus, and so I'm writing. I'm finishing up finally an article on that, and it's very interesting that the revival played of and Razali himself as a figure played very interesting roles in Andalusi politics and the development of religious thought in Al-Andalus. There are a lot of myths that emerged about Ghazali favoring different regimes in Al-Andalus and in the Maghreb at the time. So that's a short article that I'm working on. Longer term, I think I'm going to continue laboring on Ghazali and trying to work also with some other scholars and kind of I'm hoping to work on a group project where we look at Ghazali's larger corpus and really as a group try to work through it and come up with a more systematic understanding of how everything fits, how it all fits together my vision of this is to use again this idea, this understanding of Ghazali as a reviver with an active revivalist agenda to see if this can give us a framework for situating some of his different works within this larger project. But we'll see. Maybe I'll find that project is confounded when we actually deal with the actual texts. So,
well, Ken, good luck. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
That was my conversation with Kenneth Garden, the first Islamic reviver, Abu Hamad al-Ghazali and his revival of the religious sciences, published with Oxford University Press in 2014. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.